Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by Simon Schuster, Jacob Kanzler, Jack Spencer, and John Roerink. A little later, Chris Hackbarth, the legislative director for the Michigan Municipal League, will be joining us. But first, we've got a potential recount in the state of Michigan on the presidential election. Hillary Clinton lost to Donald Trump in this state by a little over 10,000 votes, and now, allegedly, Jill Stein is trying to organize a recount to challenge those results. And I don't know how much Hillary Clinton is involved in this, guys, but I got to believe for her supporters, this is equivalent of the third stage of grief right here. They've already gone through the anger and the denial. I think we're on the bargaining stage right now, John, as far as accepting the results of this election.
I think we're on the bargaining phase as well, because if you think about the odds of what's going to happen here, just looking at the math, obviously Michigan has 16 electoral college votes. Pennsylvania has 20. If she flips those two states, it goes 270, 270 in electoral college, goes to the U.S. House of Representatives. She really has to turn out over the election results in three states to make this a lock in terms of her getting the presidency back. I mean, it's just such a long shot. We're beyond a Hail Mary. We're like triple Hail Mary pass here.
But I do think it further delegitimizes the Trump victory, and I think they figure, they being those behind it, consider that as part of what they get out of doing this. And just the longer they keep feeding those scenarios and so on, they figure there's a political plus for them. People remember afterward just that, oh, yes, and there were three recounts afterward and blah, 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 and it throws all of those clouds on the victory.
But to their point, though, we had an election here where already 3,000 votes have been, roughly 2,000 to 3,000 votes, have already switched from Donald Trump to Hillary Clinton. So who's to say that a hand recount wouldn't be able to provide more than that, Jacob?
Yeah, and it was pointed out this morning that, you know, that can go both ways. When you recount votes, it could go you could get more for Trump, you could get more for Clinton. I mean, it's still a gamble. I mean, I guess it's still kind of a projection of whether you actually get more votes for the camp that you're trying to get votes for.
How are you able to do this, Simon? If you can find 10,000 more Hillary Clinton votes, if you're the Republican Party, how do you not challenge the entire election system? How do you not bring this to court?
The Republican Party or the Democratic Party?
I would say the Republican Party. If you're able to switch the actual results in this state for Donald Trump, I don't know how this doesn't end up in court.
Well, I mean, certainly that could be one implication, but I think that more than anything, I mean, the motivation behind this is there's no evidence that, you know, widespread voter fraud, which would be the only thing that could turn it over for Clinton, occurred. Except aside from the fact that a cybersecurity expert at the University of Michigan, along with a couple of other experts in election law, said that it's technically possible. And so what I think this really represents is a masterstroke in public relations for the Green Party. They've gotten more visibility than they ever have during the general election campaign for this, and they've raised millions of dollars on it as well. And you could say, of course, that this visibility and this PR is an innocuous byproduct of, you know, this attempt to ensure election integrity, as Jill Stein's campaign manager has said. But I think at the same time, it also is really leveraging the momentum that is among the liberal base that they are, you know, deeply frustrated with the results.
Or it looks like they're sore losers.
Yeah, certainly.
Now, explain how this could technically be possible, where something could have happened to screw around with the results.
Well, essentially, because Michigan is based upon an optical scan system, all these paper ballots exist. And part of the source of their concern that Jill Stein brought up is that there is a whopping 87,000 ballots that did not have a presidential candidate voted for in this election. And with a margin of victory of only 10,000 votes, what they're saying is that if there's a physical recount, that perhaps some of them could go for one candidate or the other. But the cybersecurity expert in the University of Michigan kind of brought a fog of scrutiny under the election's outcome by pointing out that it is technically possible to implant malware in the memory cards that are used to print the ballot layouts for the optical scan machines. It means that the malware would be on the memory cards before Election Day during the testing, but not activated until Election Day itself. And then when activated, essentially miscount the votes that are being automatically read into the machine, and then delete itself without a trace afterwards. And so they're saying that his argument is the only way to be 100% verifiably certain is to do a physical recount.
It sounds like the script for a Jason Bourne movie is what it sounds like to me, guys.
I'm picturing, you know, Russian spies, you know, crawling around the Delta Charter Township clerk's office and implanting these bugs in computers that are going to self-destruct at midnight on November the 8th.
I think there's a couple things to remember here. It was Donald Trump who, during the election, talked about a rigged election. So to some extent, he set a pattern on this where you can kind of say, well, he broached the topic, and so, you know, what goes around comes around. On the other hand, in terms of these numbers, look, everybody remembers the 2000 race in Florida. I think what people might forget is that the newspapers at the time, I'm pretty sure, I think it was the New York Times, maybe it was a Miami paper, I can't recall for sure which, did all the scenarios of the kind of recounts that Gore could have asked for, including statewide. And only one came out with it flipping for Gore. And the point there being, they were only talking about 500 and some votes.
We're talking about 100,000 votes here. 100,000 votes have to be flipped. You've got to flip. He won Pennsylvania by 70,000 votes. He won this state by 10,000 votes. He won Wisconsin by 20,000 votes. 100,000 votes are going to suddenly miraculously appear?
What if there was some type of fiddling around with the optical scan machines, and what if the votes were miscounted? And it's not a question of seeing something the optical scans didn't see. It's a
that's always been a possibility. And does this mean we're going to have to hand count every vote in every presidential election going forward because there's a 0.1% chance that somebody might have tampered with a machine somewhere? Come on.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to get down. When you do these recounts, you get down the slippery slope. I mean, if the election does go the other way, then President-elect Trump would want to challenge those results. It's, you know, it's how far down the rabbit hole do you want to challenge results?
I think it is important to note, though, that Democrats throughout this thing have taken probably the wise tack of saying that we don't think that there has been widespread voter fraud. We don't think that a lot of these votes are discounted. And this is not nearly as far as our own president-elect has gone by saying that there's millions of illegal votes in other states that went blue. I think that this could be potentially a boon to the Democratic base.
Now, how so?
Well, I think if you look back to the 2000 election and the fact that George W. Bush won the state by, based upon the official recount, a little more than 500 votes. What this did is that the drawn-out, protracted nature of this election result galvanized the Democrats and really kind of made the base much more stalwart against the idea of Bush enacting a sweeping mandate to rule. Or
agree, Jack?
Yeah. I mean, there's no question, I think, that put a chip on the shoulder of Democrats, and I think they actually, it helped them mobilize in the decade following that recount.
We're going to move on here. We're going to talk with Chris here in a little bit about lame duck, but I'm starting to question, guys, how much we're actually going to see this lame duck of really any substance. John, this isn't a situation where the Senate has a lame duck, right? And we have a House that is not going to change in any way really substantially. How much do you think we're going to see this lame duck?
I think it's going to be, I mean, I think they'll move a number of pieces, but I don't think we're going to see any late night sessions. I don't see them going in past what they've already scheduled as far as session days. I don't think there's any incentive there. I mean, if they can get energy, they'll get energy. There's a couple other things we've talked about that they're going to try to tackle. And then I think it's going to be a pretty quiet, non-quacking duck.
The last lame duck, as it always turns out, there will be one late night session at the end, the grand finale, as they're trying to push their final bills through. Mm-hmm. But as far as continuous late night sessions, I don't really see the table being set for something like that, Jack. Do you?
Only on energy. Energy is the wild card here that we don't know how hard it's going to be to get that in the House. If they drag it out until the last day, that's when you might see something. I think it's basically my forecast of this is going to be all about the lame duck's going to be all about energy and then dogs and cats.
I think we'll know a lot more about energy by the end of the week whether there's an appetite to hold off on it or to do it in a lame duck.
You think there's still a possibility they don't do it in lame duck, John?
Hey, look, there's all sorts of uncertainty out there. I could see caucus members saying, why don't we just wait?
Well, why don't we wait? Because then we've got another 2 years where this is the discussion again, and it eats up the entire session. If I'm Tom Leonard, I don't want this energy thing hanging around. I want this thing done and over with so I can move on to no fault in my tenure and some other issues that I'd like to address. I don't want this leftover hanging over my caucus.
Well, there's a lot of money being invested by a lot of people in this thing, and I don't know if that would hurt a lot of people's feelings if it did continue.
Yeah, but as far as that money goes, if I'm DT and if I'm consumers, do I want to continue to feed the beast here? I mean, because you fed them for 2 years and they did nothing for you. So at what point do you just do the stick instead of the carrot and turn off the spigot?
Well, I don't know. I think that that's, I have heard both in calling around off the record. I have heard people swear this thing is dead on arrival in the house. I have heard people say exactly the opposite, that no, this is grease, this is ready to go. And so it just ends up being the, you know, who do you want to believe and which version do you want to put your money on?
I give it an 85 to 90% chance of passing the house in lame duck, John. Is that overly optimistic?
I don't know. Like I said, we'll know shortly. I'm not gonna risk pegging odds on it.
All right, joining us now for the podcast, Chris Hackbarth. He's with the Michigan Municipal League. Thanks for joining us, Chris.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Kyle.
Well, let's talk about one of the issues that is kind of bubbling up as a lame duck issue, and that is retiree health care for municipal employees. Give us kind of some background here and why this is an issue that we should even be focused on in the first place.
Well, the league has been working on the whole topic of municipal finance for over a year now, trying to have these conversations with the administration, House and Senate, just to try and help folks understand what's happened to municipalities across the state in terms of what they're dealing with, whether it's their costs, whether it's the structure issues, or the revenue problems that have been happening over the last 10 years. And OPEB, retiree health care, is definitely one of the key drivers of costs that local units are facing.
Can you put a number figure to it? I mean, how big of a problem are we talking?
So according to an MSU study based upon 2014 data, statewide we're looking at about $11 billion unfunded on the healthcare side alone. That equals out to be, on average, 13 to 14% of a budget for a municipality.
And this is impacting some cities more than others, from what I understand.
Absolutely. I mean, healthcare, depending on the age of the community, the age of the workforce, do they have a long-time workforce or not? Certainly, you have some communities that did not, you know, have developed very recently and didn't have these legacy costs that older cities, even some cities you wouldn't normally think of, in that pot. That, you know, when you're talking really across the state, from north, south, east, west, there are communities everywhere that have this healthcare issue.
Give us some examples. Where is this the most pressing?
I don't think you could say most pressing in any one place. It is this problem exists in every corner of the state. When you're talking a city that might have lost 30 to 40% of their property tax base during the Great Recession, and then they've had revenue sharing cuts, so those are their two primary sources of revenue. They've been decimated. And then you see double-digit spikes in healthcare premiums. You know, that is a recipe for disaster.
Yeah. So when we're talking about OPEB and doing reforms, instantly people think, you're going to cut my benefits. Is that what that means?
I think from the league standpoint, we absolutely believe that municipalities need to be able to continue to offer very good benefits. We have to attract and retain talent. We need good people in the public sector. We need good police. We need good fire. Public works, we obviously have seen that recently. It's very important to have good public works employees. You know, those kind of things require a level of compensation and benefits that will allow us to attract people to those sectors. So we need to continue to offer it, but we need to be able to offer it at manageable costs and known costs. That's one of the biggest things is the unknown of what's going on in healthcare.
A lot of our listeners obviously have heard this issue come up as a possible lame duck issue. Is there a way to sort of explain from the league's position what's the best way to tackle this? I mean, for us non-municipal finance experts, what would you ideally like to see done?
That's a very good question. I think this was a question we were preparing to have the conversation on in the new term. Certainly having things potentially accelerated, we're not really sure if anything will happen in lame duck or not. A lot of mixed signals on that front. But, you know, I think when we look at the situation, there are some certain parameters that I think everybody probably can agree to. You know, for retirees that reach the age of 65, Medicare should be the primary insurance. There are some instances where that's not the case. For, you know, modern plan design options, are communities able to put in place modern plan design, HMOs, the prescription drug coverage, you know, that's kind of standard. We've got communities out there with $2 drug cards. $2 copay on a prescription drug today is a completely different cost structure than it was 15 years ago.
That sounds like a good idea, John. $2 copay?
If you can find it.
Can't find it here.
So that, you know, I've got some communities that have shared stories with me about, you know, where they've gone from, they've been able to convince their retiree units to go from a $2 copay to a zero generic $15 name brand. And that saved them $300,000. I mean, so those are the kind of things that I think we believe should be part of the conversation. We'd not walk into this with any preconceived idea of what the solution is. We want to have the conversation. We're trying to be prepared in case the conversation happens in the next 6 weeks.
How realistic is it to think that retiree health care, that people are going to lose their health care? I'm going to put it that way. That retirees of a municipality are going to lose their health care as a part of this discussion?
I have not heard any rumors about elimination of health care. We are certainly not advocating for that. As I said, we want to make sure that we're able to offer a good competitive benefit package to be able to continue to keep talent.
Isn't this, though, something that each municipality could tackle on their own? I mean, as far as changing the benefit structure, I mean, why do we need the legislature's involvement?
I think the biggest question on the retiree side for healthcare is the uneven legal landscape right now. When you're looking at what's happened, depending on the types of contracts that have been maybe 15, 20 years ago that someone operated on and retired under, are they represented today? Who represents them? How are changes able to be instituted? Again, that modern plan design conversation, how do you get there? So I think there's a lot of unknowns in that part of the world. And so that's why, again, we think it's important that we have a good legal structure for how we can get that done. I don't know what the specific answer is yet, but that's something that we need to talk about.
How long of a conversation is this? I mean, is this something that you see taking an entire session? Is it even something you can push through in a lame duck?
I'm probably the wrong guy to ask that of. I mean, I have to be, as an organization, we have to be prepared to have this conversation whenever it's put upon us. Again, we were kind of working under the assumption this was something we would work on in the new term, preparing right now for whatever comes our way.
Now, in a previous life, you were also at the Secretary of State's office. So I know that you have some experience on Secretary of State and elections issue, being also a longtime staffer in this town. The prospects of a recount in this state, tell me what your impressions are of what that looks like.
A statewide recount, I think, I can't remember the last one, if we've even had one in recent history. You know, we've had these conversations when it happened in the state house level. You see even the Rogers-Byram matchup for Congress. Very few votes actually change. Michigan's done a very good job of putting in place equipment that has a paper backup trail. So the paper ballots are there for everyone that you can audit if necessary. And the machines are tested multiple times before ballots go into them. They're scanned ballots. There is no hacking that could take place from that aspect. They're not even connected. Those machines aren't even connected to the internet. I think based upon the technology, I think they still have fax lines.
Well, one of the questions that we had talking about, apparently the computer scientist argued that someone could actually get into the machine, implant a bug, that bug would then erase itself. Is that even possible?
So the machines are sealed. They have specific seals on them. If the seal is broken, you know, all the testing that would have to take place. Now, and I don't even know if there is software program. I mean, the level of software programming in these machines is not state of the art. This stuff is, these machines, I think most folks would probably tell you, were at the end of their kind of life cycle when they were first bought by the state, but they were so they were obsolete technology.
Something about state's technology purchasing habits.
We're buying absolute stuff here.
But that's, when you think about it, that's, you know, it was tried and true and well tested and been out on the market forever. And like I said, they still have fax line connections. There's no internet connections to these things. So for someone to get in, you'd have to go township by township, city by city, getting into all of their machines and implanting some bug. You'd have, I mean, the level of coordination and access you'd have to have, I just don't see it.
I think you said it would, it's like a Jason Bourne movie.
Yeah, or Tom Cruise. Could Mission Impossible team crack this case?
Yeah, right. Like I said, I think any recount you've seen take place at the other levels has shown very minimal vote changing. We don't have hanging chads.
No.
So you don't sound confident that there will be 10,000 Hillary votes out there to be found?
I don't think so, no.
All right. Well, if nothing else, we've given some screen fodder to some screenwriter out there for a next Mission Impossible movie.
Oh, sorry, that's James Bond.
Chris, thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me today.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Thanks to the crew here, Chris Ackbarth for joining us, Jacob, Simon, Jack, and John. I'd like to thank our sponsor, AT&T, for sponsoring this and all our podcasts. We are still having a debate in the office whether the Michigan loss to Ohio State had to do with bad officiating or whether Jim Harbaugh was boo-hooing. We're going to talk to our resident Michigan fan. He was boo-hooing, wasn't he, Jack? Come on.
Well, I think that he had the two plays there at the end that he thought were in the overtime, that he thought were bad calls. And I think he didn't have time to think about it. But I, frankly, even though I'm a Michigan fan, I think what's-his-name did make the first down. So I disagree with him on that. And you sort of just take it the way you take it in terms of the officiating on pass interference. So
I'm sorry. I shouldn't be crying. I should be only crying because my team is 3-9, you know, right? I mean, isn't that why we should be crying?
Well, here's the interesting take. Now, if Harbaugh had done the D'Antonio thing in the overtime, like Spate apparently wanted him to, and gone for two, you know, would they have made it, and would we be talking about Michigan going on now?
Should we all be rallying around our first place Detroit Lions?
Absolutely.
That only encourages them.
So. Yeah, exactly. That's in the next podcast when we talk about Jack goes off on the Detroit Lions. Tune in next week to hear that edition. Until then, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.